Board of the State of South Dakota, the Honorable Chief Justice David Gilderson presiding, is now in session.
Please be seated. Well, we'll go to the obvious first. There's four of us up here, which is living proof that judges are no more immune from the flu bug than anybody else. Judge Severson has come down with the flu, and will not be sitting here with us today, but the proceedings are recorded, and he will be fully participating in the case. With that, the first case for oral argument this morning is State v. Sean Ross. For the appellant, we have Mr. Douglas Papendick, an attorney from Mitchell. And for the appellee, State of South Dakota, we have Mr. Grant Flynn, an assistant attorney general from Pierre. Mr. Papendick, you may proceed, sir, and you have 20 minutes.
Thank you.
May it please the court, counsel. The first thing I'd like to indicate before I get into argument is that I have the greatest admiration and respect for Judge Bruce Anderson. I've been in front of him several times, both as a magistrate judge and a circuit court judge. He has made very reasoned decisions, a very fair judge, and it pains me to be here to argue a case involving one of his decisions. But with that said, I would like to briefly go over some of the facts of this case.
Were you the counsel for the defendant in the courtroom?
Not initially. He was initially represented by Teresa Mall, an attorney out of Chamberlain. He wasn't happy with her representation. She was made an advisory counsel, and she was there at the time of sentencing on June 13th.
So the day of the hand signal, she was there and you weren't?
That's correct.
Okay, thank you.
Yes, I was not a witness to the action. Reading through the transcripts, he was sentenced on that day to 5 years in the South Dakota State Penitentiary with 3.5 years suspended. He had fully expected to be released that day under presumptive probation. He was not. Consequently, when he was leaving the courtroom, he apparently flipped the court the bird. Judge Anderson saw that, called him back into the courtroom. The deputy sheriff brought him back in. The court placed
now,
on
my understanding is he never left the courtroom. Is that correct?
That is correct. He was probably somewhere by the door. I think he did make it past the bar and was probably in the audience area at the time. But that's just my guess.
Sure. I realize you're not making a record as this is going on, so.
Right. In any event, the court placed on the record that he flipped the court the bird, and the court indicated, for that reason, the court is modifying its sentence. Judge Anderson reimposed the suspended 3.5 years and gave him the full 5 years in the South Dakota State Penitentiary, at which time the defendant commented, "I'll get my day, same to you." Judge Anderson, at that point, held the defendant in contempt, gave him 30 days for the contemptuous comment or behavior. The defendant said, "Well, give me a year, I don't care, do what you gotta do." Court gave him another 30 days for contempt. Later on, rescinded the extra 30 days. He served that before he was sent to the penitentiary. In the meantime, he made a motion to modify his sentence or have the sentence possibly a resentencing hearing. The court granted that motion. At that point, Judge Anderson had contacted me to come in and represent him. He explained the circumstances of the case. I came in and I was present when he was resentenced. I think it was in September 5th.
So, Mr. Papendick, let me ask you this. You've got a defendant who, flips the judge the bird. The judge has all these other defendants, public in the courtroom, lawyers in the courtroom, things like that. Under your argument, then the judge really have his hands tied in terms of what he or she can do in response to something like that?
That is correct. The issue is whether the court can actually do that. We have no issue regarding the contemptuous behavior and the back talk to the court. Clearly, he was in contempt of court. We're not arguing that. The issue here is whether the court can rescind or modify a sentence that had just been pronounced.
So where do you draw the line? I mean, there's got to be a line somewhere where the sentence becomes final.
Yes, and this court has ruled previously that immediately after a sentence is pronounced, it cannot be enhanced. In this case, our argument is that once the sentence was handed down, it's immediate. It doesn't matter where he's at in the courtroom. Sentence was pronounced.
But let's say a judge pronounces a sentence and he thinks he's completed his work, and then the defense attorney stands up and says, Your Honor, are these concurrent or consecutive? Or, Your Honor, does he get credit for time served? Well, the sentence has been granted. Does the judge have authority then to address those issues?
That would be under SDCL 23A31-2, where the statute talks about clerical mistakes, and in State versus, or excuse me, it's Lichen versus Class, the court pronounced a sentence, pronounced two sentences, I think. The issue was whether the sentences were consecutive or concurrent. The attorneys met with the court, I believe in the chambers, after the sentencing. The court went back on his notes, noted that he intended to make those sentences consecutive, and he clarified the issue, and this court had decided that under those circumstances, a judge can do that.
All right, so counsel, in this case, were not both the prosecutor and defense counsel at the bench seeking further clarification from the judge?
Yes,
about
that
various
was on,
terms
that was
of
on,
the sentence?
Yes, that was on the terms of the court's decisions, not on enhancing the sentence. Entirely different thing.
But doesn't that show that the proceeding had not concluded?
I believe it had. It's our argument that it had concluded. In fact, Judge Anderson had said something to the effect, that's the sentence. You're remanded to the custody of the sheriff.
Well, whether you want to argue that, you know, it ended when the judge had said those words or not, there's no dispute the defendant's still in the courtroom at the time. When the judge says stop, bring him back, everybody brings him back. That's a different setting than once the defendant's sitting down in the jail or in prison. Judge doesn't have the ability to go down there and say, hey, I want you to do this or do that. Wouldn't you agree?
That's absolutely correct, yes.
So it's a little bit of a kind of a fine line there you're drawing, wouldn't you agree?
Right. I could not find any direct case law on something like this. We've had instances where a case was brought back before the court within an hour. Clearly, that would be enhancing a sentence. In this case, the defendant was in the courtroom, but our argument is that the sentence had already been pronounced, and simply because of his contemptuous behavior, it had been enhanced.
What if he'd been still sitting in his chair at the table, and as soon as he heard the words from the judge, he flips them off? Is it still too late?
It would be our contention that if the court had said that is the decision of the court, you're remanded to the custody of the sheriff, and he was still sitting at the table, it would be our argument here today the same as what it would have been if he were walking out the door.
Okay, thank you.
So your client filed a motion pro se for resentencing?
He did.
And in fact, a resentencing hearing was held?
Yes.
And what is the effect of that request for resentencing with reference to your argument?
The argument is this. He was sentenced on in June, and then he was resentenced in September. the sentence that was handed down in June, we're contending that the original sentence of 5 years with 3.5 years suspended could not be enhanced. Then he was resentenced in September. Now the court gave him still 2 months more than the original sentence. In the event this court decides that the original sentence of 5 years was valid, that the court did not err, then we lose the argument that his, you know, he made a motion to modify the original sentence. Then our argument fails. If, on the other hand, this court decides that the trial court erred in June, then the state's argument fails. So it's very simple.
Thank you. You argued at the resentencing, Mr. Papadek, didn't you, that the judge couldn't give him more than the 18 months he had initially given him?
That's our argument.
And that's what you argued in front of Judge Anderson?
Yes, I did. Mm-hmm. He was given initially 5 years with 3.5 suspended. At resentencing, he was given 60 months with 40 months suspended. So do the math, he got 2 extra months. Now, the state has basically a threefold argument. One is that the sentence was not enhanced, it was simply reinstated. The second argument is that he had not yet begun serving his sentence because he had simply not left the courtroom. And then the third argument is that since his motion for sentence reduction was granted and he was given less than the 5 years, then that argument on our side fails. So if we look at the state's first argument, was Mr. Ross's sentence enhanced or was it simply reinstated? Now there are safeguards, and in this case, Mr. Ross was under the Department of Corrections. Once he got sentenced, he's in the executive branch now. He's not in the judicial anymore. Judge Anderson even made reference in the sentence that one of the conditions is that he pay restitution pursuant to a plan by the parole board. And if we look at the safeguards for revocation of a suspended sentence, SDCL 24-15-20 talks about the Department of Corrections filing an order to show cause. Now, in my original brief, I have to apologize. I cited 24-25-20. I made a clerical error. It's actually 24-15-20. But in this case, Mr. Ross was given no advisement of rights. There were no revocation proceedings. There was no hearing or a trial. There were no due process safeguards there. It is our argument that he should have at least been entitled to that, but only through the Department of Corrections. We're also arguing that this is not the judge correcting a mistake. The man was brought back into the courtroom simply because he had flipped the court the bird and he was given an enhanced sentence. If you look at the cases involving State versus Marshak and Lycan v. Class, and I have those cases and the state does as well, those cases are cited in our briefs. Second argument that the state brings up is that he had not yet begun serving his sentence because he had not left the courtroom. So the issue, had he begun serving his sentence? And there are several cases that address this issue. Again, State versus Marshak, State versus Ford, State versus Jackson. In those cases, This court has indicated that a defendant's sentence commences immediately after the oral sentence is pronounced. Once a defendant suffers some confinement in the custody of a sheriff, his sentence begins, which is the case here. He was let out by the deputy sheriff, Brule County. And this court has also said that as against an unwilling defendant, a valid sentence cannot be increased in severity after he has commenced the serving thereof.
Let me ask you this, Mr. Papadakis, on that argument. The judge, as I alluded to earlier, the judge is in control of the courtroom. I don't think we've had a case where the judge changed the sentence while the defendant is still in the courtroom. What's the downside, other than the defendant gets an enhanced sentence, to your client? What's the downside of allowing the judge to modify the sentence or take into account all the circumstances going on in the courtroom and responding to those circumstances and having the flexibility to impose that sentence or modify the sentence as he or she determines until the defendant leaves the courtroom?
I think a court can modify a sentence, but only if it makes a lesser sentence.
What I'm asking is, what's the downside of giving the judge that flexibility in the courtroom?
There's a delineation here between sentencing and a contempt action. In this case, there were both. And it's a little bit of a hazy line between the contemptuous behavior and the sentencing by the court. The court did both in this case. In this case, he held the defendant in contempt of court, but prior to the court saying that he was in contempt, he modified the sentence. There was no mention of the word contempt until after he reimposed the full 5 years. So if I'm understanding your question, the downside is that the defendant here received an enhanced sentence. It's our contention he was in the executive branch of government at that point. Unless there's any other questions, it's our contention that, or we would ask the court to consider reversing the decision by the trial court, remanding this case back to the trial court for resentencing with a sentence not to exceed the 18 months previously imposed.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Papendick.
Thank you.
Mr. Flynn, you have 20 minutes, sir.
May it please the court, counsel. The trial court in this case acted within its broad sentencing discretion when it imposed Mr. Ross's 5-year sentence. This case is factually distinguishable from prior cases where this court has found an unlawful increase in a sentence after the defendant had commenced serving it. Here, Mr. Ross had not yet begun serving his sentence because his sentencing hearing had not concluded and his custody or his confinement had not been transferred to the sheriff or law enforcement. This case is also distinguishable in that Mr. Ross's overall penitentiary exposure was not actually increased. The trial court merely restructured the terms of his confinement. Just a brief recitation of the facts. Mr. Ross was charged with third-degree burglary and pled guilty to that crime and also agreed to pay restitution for damage to a change machine that he attempted to steal the contents of. At his sentencing hearing, the trial court sentenced him to 5 years in the penitentiary. Initially, the trial court intended to suspend 3.5 years of that sentence. While the sentencing hearing was ongoing, while trial counsel and the state continued to ask clarifying questions of the sentence, and while the trial court continued to pronounce that sentence, Mr. Ross stood from the defense table, began walking across the courtroom, and raise his hand, flipping the bird, or extending his middle finger at the trial court. At that point, the trial court called Mr. Ross back to the defense table and informed him that he would be serving the full 5-year sentence with no time suspended. Mr. Ross reacted to that, engaging in a verbal altercation with the trial court, which caused him to receive 2 additional contempt citations and 1 additional 30-day jail sentence. After the sentencing hearing, Mr. Ross issued a letter of remorse to the trial court, and a motion to modify his sentence was filed. There was a hearing held on that motion, and the trial court made the decision to resentence him to, again, a 5-year or 60-month sentence with 40 months of that sentence suspended. This court reviews trial court sentencing decisions for an abuse of discretion, which is a fundamental error in judgment or a choice outside the range of permissible choices. This court has also found that a trial court cannot increase a valid sentence against an unwilling defendant once that defendant has commenced serving his sentence. A defendant commences serving a sentence once he suffers some confinement at the hands of the sheriff or law enforcement. Here, Mr. Ross had not yet commenced serving his sentence. His sentencing hearing was ongoing, the sentencing court was continuing to pronounce details of his sentence, and both his advisory counsel and the state were asking clarifying questions about that sentence, which the trial court was answering.
But he wasn't at his liberty. I mean, you'd agree he was confined to a certain extent. He couldn't have continued out the door and on his way.
I agree that that's true, Your Honor. Much like anyone in any kind of courtroom setting or hearing would not, during those proceedings, just stand up and walk out of the courtroom. It's, I believe, a fair reading of the record that Mr. Ross was probably transported from, custody, from confinement into the courtroom, would likely be transferred back. However, that remains that the facts of this case are that his sentencing hearing had not concluded, and I think there's a slight distinction between how Mr. Papendick characterized the state's argument and what we intend to argue before this court today, that it's not because the sentencing hearing ended that his confinement hadn't begun. That's just one fact that supports that argument, that Mr. Ross had not yet suffered that confinement at the hands of the sheriff because he was still in the courtroom and his sentencing hearing was still ongoing. For example, it's unlikely that any court would, while it was still pronouncing a defendant's sentence, instruct the sheriff or the bailiff to escort him out of the courtroom and take him down to the holding cell. That part of the process wouldn't happen until the sentencing hearing concluded and the trial court chose to remand him to the custody of the sheriff.
So after the contemptuous behavior, prior to the contemptuous behavior, the court said the sentencing hearing is concluded. The court verbally spoke that out, and then on the way out the door or to his seat, we have the contemptuous act.
Yes, Your Honor. However, I think since you mentioned that specific language, I think it's worth delving into that a little bit deeper because I do believe those words of the trial court are somewhat open to interpretation. At the point that I believe what the trial court said is, that's my sentence, that concludes the matter. Immediately preceding that statement by the trial court, the defendant had been engaging in sort of a colloquy or a back and forth with the trial court where he was arguing about how much time he would have to spend and essentially complaining about the amount of jail time that he received. So I believe, one interpretation could be that the trial court was ending the matter and pronouncing, a finalized version of the sentence. However, that isn't necessarily consistent with the rest of the record where the trial court continued to pronounce additional details of that sentence. I think another interpretation of that statement is to say that the trial court was ending argument on the sentencing hearing. He was informing the defendant that he wasn't going to hear any more debate about what an appropriate jail sentence is, and this was the amount of time that he was going to sentence the defendant to. And so he was not necessarily establishing this is a finite end to this hearing. He was just saying that the opportunity for argument is closed and we're going to continue pronouncing the sentence to wrap this hearing up.
See, but that's part of the problem, isn't it? When he says the argument's completed and foreclosed. I mean, obviously the judge went through the PSI, thought about his sentence before he went in the courtroom, comes into the courtroom, he's responding to a specific situation, brings the defendant back in, doesn't ask for argument from the lawyers, doesn't ask for input from the defendant, just imposes an additional sentence. You know, that's, isn't that one of the reasons why we have finality of sentences and judgments, so that you don't have a situation where maybe you're responding to a motion rather than having thought through your sentence and considered what's appropriate?
I certainly agree with you, with your point, Justice. I think that, again, there's a distinguishing fact here where the sentencing hearing was still ongoing and the trial court had continuing authority to augment the terms of that sentence. I think it's important to keep in mind that a trial court has a responsibility to familiarize itself with the character and the history of the defendant before it. And that's precisely why arguments made at a sentencing hearing. The state provides argument, the defendant and the defense counsel, and even the defendant gets to provide some argument or have words with the trial counsel to explain what it thinks an appropriate sentence would be. Because Mr. Ross's sentencing hearing was ongoing, Mr. Ross's actions can be used as a part of this trial court's determination about Mr. Ross's character and what an appropriate sentence would be. So here, the trial court initially planned to provide leniency to this defendant. However, once he observed Mr. Ross's character and gleaned a more thorough appreciation of his character based on his actions, the trial court made the determination, one, that he did not merit the leniency that it had originally intended to provide, and two, that he would not be an appropriate candidate for the parole system, thus making him more appropriate for the full 5-year penitentiary sentence. Again, this case is significantly distinguishable from the prior cases where this court has found those unlawful increases in a sentence. In State v. Ford, the trial court sentenced a defendant on a drug conviction to 36 months in the state penitentiary. That defendant was remanded, sat in a holding cell for 3 days, and then was called back before the sentencing court, where the court imposed a 10-year penitentiary sentence. Similarly, in State v. Buchholz, a DUI defendant who was sentenced on 2 separate DUI convictions to consecutive 5-month sentences was remanded for approximately an hour, where he sat in a holding cell when the trial court discovered that the defendant had been dishonest about his continued drinking. And the trial court brought him back and said that there was going to be a resentencing hearing. At the resentencing hearing, one of those consecutive 5-month sentences was increased to a 2-year sentence.
So are you suggesting that this is a matter of turf, that this defendant here was on the judge's turf in the judge's courtroom, but in the two cases you just talked about, he was in the sheriff's turf in the cells? Is that the distinction?
I'll have to admit I had not thought about it in those terms, Justice, but I have to say that I think that that's an apt description. As you said, the trial court has authority in his courtroom, has authority to run his courtroom and maintain order and decorum in that courtroom. Here, because the sentencing hearing had not concluded, Mr. Ross's custody had not been transferred to the sheriff, he had not yet been remanded, and so his sentence had not commenced. And because he had not begun serving that sentence yet, he was still on the judge's turf, and the judge maintained ongoing authority to adjust the terms of that sentence.
Well, if he hadn't been remanded, why was he with the sheriff walking out of the courtroom?
The record doesn't make that clear. I suppose it could be for safety reasons. I don't know. What I do know is that the sentencing hearing was still ongoing because the trial court continued to pronounce the details of that sentence. The defense's advisory counsel had asked questions about parole eligibility. The state was continuing to ask questions about court-appointed attorney's fees and things of that nature. And there's no debate, and defendant has not raised any question as to whether or not those are parts of the sentence. So the sentencing hearing was ongoing, and the continuing discussion became a part of that sentence.
Is that really accurate, though, if the defendant's already been dismissed and walking out of the courtroom? Is it appropriate for them to be continuing the sentencing hearing?
I think the state's position would be that it's not appropriate, but again, those aren't the facts of this case. Here, the defendant remained in the courtroom, all parties remained in the courtroom, and the conversation about the sentence
was
ongoing.
Right, but he was excused, left the table, and walking out. He wasn't engaged in what the lawyers in the court were doing at that point, was he?
Again, I don't know that the record makes that clear. I think it's a fair reading of the record. The expectation was that he was still engaged because the sentencing hearing was ongoing. I can't say exactly, you know, there was reference made to the fact that there were defendants still in the courtroom. It's possible that the intent was for him to remain there. The record does not make that clear. What the record does make clear is that the sentence was still being pronounced and the sentencing hearing had not concluded. And again, this court has held that a sentence is final once the defendant commences serving that sentence. And here that had not happened yet. This case is also distinguishable in that Mr. Ross's overall sentence was not actually increased. His sentence was just restructured. The sentencing court initially sentenced defendant to a full five-year sentence, or to five-year sentence, imposed that full five-year sentence after gleaning further information about the defendant's character, and still, even after the resentencing hearing, kept the maximum possible penitentiary exposure at 5 years. Now, this is a distinguishing fact from, again, those prior cases that I've already discussed, State v. Ford and State v. Buchholz, where there was a significant increase in the maximum possible time that the defendant could have spent in the penitentiary, from 36 months to 10 years, from 5 months to 2 years. And so this is a factual situation that this court has not yet addressed, where we have a defendant who was initially sentenced to 5 years and continues to be sentenced to 5 years. It's merely the potential parole eligibility that was restructured or reconfigured.
No, that's not right, because he's going to have to serve more time. Even after parole, the initial parole date will be longer because it'll have to be calculated on a sentence that's 2 months longer than the original sentence.
Well, and the state's argument would be that his presumptive parole date might change, but his overall penitentiary exposure remained the same. Dependent on Mr. Ross's actions, the possibility always existed that he would could have to serve that 5 years. I am not as familiar with the parole process and how that part of it works, but there is certainly the possibility when you go into the penitentiary with a five-year sentence, even with suspended time, that you could end up serving that full five-year sentence, which, again, I don't know is a determinative fact, but is certainly a distinguishable fact between this case and prior cases, where this court has directly addressed significant increases in the overall maximum penitentiary exposure.
So if the court had given a suspended execution, a sentence, put him on probation, same thing happens, calls him back up and gives him the max, would that be okay?
And I don't believe that we have to address that here, because Mr. Ross's sentence had not commenced. So whether or not, you know, Mr. Papendick discussed whether or not he was in the parole system, whether or not he was subject to the Board of Pardons and Paroles, whether he was subject to the executive or the judicial branch. And the reality is this court just doesn't have to address those issues because Mr. Ross's sentencing hearing had not yet concluded. Because he had not commenced serving his sentence and his custody had not been transferred to the sheriff, his sentencing hearing was ongoing and his sentence had not yet commenced. So there's no issue as to whether or not he was in custody of the executive branch or the judicial branch or who had the authority to revoke the possible suspended portion of his sentence, because the sentencing hearing just had not started, or the sentence had not started yet, because his sentencing hearing had not concluded. The one question that was posed to Mr. Papendick that I would like to address, if I might, was the downside of allowing this modification. and there is none. Because the trial court had this responsibility to familiarize itself with the character and the history of the defendant, it could use the information that it learned about the defendant at the sentencing hearing to influence its sentencing decisions. And that's exactly what happened here. The sentencing hearing was ongoing. The trial court gleaned new modification about, or I apologize, gleaned new information about the defendant during that sentencing hearing before the defendant had commenced serving his sentence, and was free and acted within its discretion to use that information during the sentencing hearing. Finally, I think it's important to note that this case is not about the decisions of the trial court. This case is about the actions of Mr. Ross and his behavior before the trial judge. The trial court acted within its discretion when it made the decision while the sentencing hearing was ongoing and while all parties remained in the courtroom to modify the terms of Mr. Ross's sentence. Mr. Ross, however, did not have any discretion to act in the way that he did in an open courtroom. If there are no other questions, for that reason, the state would respectfully request that this court affirm Mr. Ross's sentence in all respects.
Thank you, counsel.
Thank you.
Mr. Papendick, you have 10 minutes for rebuttal, sir.
Yes, Your Honor, just briefly.
The state is contending that the sentencing here was ongoing. In this case, simply the court had said, well, that's my sentence. That concludes the matter. At that point, Ms. Mall had a question about a probationary period. The court indicated it's prison, it's for parole. And then there was just a brief question about whether court-appointed attorney's fees should be included in the sentence. That's not uncommon. It's not uncommon in a courtroom for attorneys to seek clarification of a sentence from a judge after the sentence had been pronounced. Whether it's a matter of the defendant still being in the courtroom or whether it's a matter of some days later, there are going to be issues like this where attorneys are seeking clarification. It's our contention that the defendant in this case began serving his sentence immediately after he was remanded to the custody of the sheriff. One of the things that like to bring up, if in this case, if the defendant had walked out of the courtroom without flipping the bird, that would have been the sentence, I'm sure. There wouldn't have been any dispute. We wouldn't be here today. But in this case, he did. He was brought back into the courtroom and his sentence was enhanced.
Well, you keep saying brought back in. He never left it, did
he? Well, that's true. He was brought back to counsel table. Well, he had not left the courtroom.
Isn't remorse a the remorse of the defendant proper item for consideration by the sentencing court? I mean, why can he accept the remorse or lack thereof prior to the defendant coming in the courtroom, but he apparently can't do that at the point in time where it occurred in the courtroom?
It is definitely consideration. If the court in this case had said, I am seriously considering giving you a year and a half in the state prison, and then the defendant flipped the court the bird, it would have been clearly within the court's discretion to give him the full 5 years. That simply didn't happen in this case. His sentence was 5 years with 3.5 years suspended, and then after he flipped the bird, he was given the full 5 years.
All right. Now, your client did not elect to appeal that five-year sentence. He didn't appeal that five-year imposition. Instead, he filed a pro se motion for resentencing.
Yes.
So does that bring him back in to the jurisdiction of the court, so to speak? He didn't take a direct appeal from the imposition of the 5 years. Instead, he took a different approach.
That's a good question. In this case, it's within a court's discretion to grant a motion for reconsideration of a sentence. And our argument would be that the court was deciding that prior to any appeal to the Supreme Court. Otherwise, unless there's some other questions.
Well, nobody's chastised for quitting early.
So okay.
I guess you have no more questions, and we thank you for your time.
Thank you.
These are two. These are on the internet, they run on the hour, so even though we got done a little bit early this morning on this case, we'll be in recess until 10 o'clock and we'll start Keystone. We're in recess.